We're at Perek Beis, Pasuk Gimel, in the middle of the Pasuk. We had discussed the expression Alachas Bidrachav, to find the ways of Hashem, and how that refers to the Midos, according to some interpretations. The Pasuk goes on to enumerate specific categories of mitzvahs, Lishmor, to observe Chukosav, Mitzvosav, Umishpatav Veidvosav. So we have four categories of mitzvahs: chukim, mitzvos, mishpatim, and edios. The generally accepted interpretation is chok are those mitzvahs for which the reason has not been revealed, and human understanding does not grasp it, things like shatnez, etc. Mitzvos are mitzvos beinonim lamakom, which perhaps we do understand the reason, things like tefillah. Mishpatim are mitzvahs beinam lechavero, for which we understand the reason, lo signov, things like that. And edvosav are mitzvahs that come to testify, or as a remembrance of some historical event, many of the mitzvahs of Yomim Tovim, matzah, you know, etc., Shabbos, is an edus on the creation of the world. So these are the mitzvahs edvosav. So David is leaving nothing to chance. You shall fulfill all the mitzvahs of the Torah, whether benom lamakom, benom lachavera, whether we understand the reasons, whether we don't understand the reasons. Kakosu b'toras Moshe. We know, of course, that Shlomo HaMelech was famous for his prodigious effort to try to understand the reasons of all the mitzvahs. And in the end he said, Amarti ech kama v'hi rechalka mimeni. Chazal say that he figured out the reasons for everything except certain aspects of the Parah Aduma. And he said, Amarti ech kama v'hi rechalka mimeni. And Mefarshim explained that, you know, you would think that if there are 613 mitzvahs, and you got 612 out of 613, actually, it was 612 and a half out of 613. So you wouldn't say, hi rechalka mimeni, it's distant from me. He came pretty close. Why did Shlomo say it's distant from him? And the answer is that if there's only one mitzvah that you can't really explain, that means you don't really understand all the other mitzvahs either. And the Torah is a system. If you properly and accurately understood the system, then everything would fit into place. So if something is out of line, then you don't understand entirely. It's, you know, to use a mushal, if somebody has a scientific theory and explains 95% of the evidence, or 99% of the evidence, but there's one case that goes against the theory, then there's a very good chance the entire theory is wrong. It's not just off by a little. The whole thing is wrong. It doesn't explain all the data. And therefore, someone did not feel, perhaps he understood certain messages and lessons that we can learn from the Torah, but to say that he's figured out the system of the Torah, he says, hi rechalka mimeni. Nevertheless, of course, there are many messages and lessons in the mitzvahs, but to say that we really understand it, we cannot say. And you know, the famous Sefer HaChinuch, which tries to explain the mitzvos, is careful in his use of words, and he says so in his Hakdamah, when he talks about what we would call reasons, he doesn't identify them as reasons. He says, Mishurashei HaMitzvos, among the roots, the sources of the mitzvah, because he never really wanted to say the word reason. You don't really know the ultimate reason of a mitzvah. The pasuk continues, you should do everything that's written in the Torah of Moshe, l'man taskil eis kol asher ta'aseh, in order that taskil eis kol asher ta'aseh, v'eis kol asher tifne Hashem, wherever you turn to. What does the word taskil mean? There is a recognizable sharesh, which when you look at the word, sort of jumps out at you, and that's the word seichel. Yet, that's not how the Targum and many others interpret it. They learn Taskil means succeed. To succeed in all that you do. And the Malbim elaborates on that a little bit further. He says that we find two words that are used to describe success. There's tatzliach, that's the more common word, hatzlacha, tatzliach, and taskil, as we have in this pasuk. The difference, he says, is that tatzliach is a success that can't be attributed to anything that you did. It's mazel. Some people, despite themselves, succeed. And just things fall into their place, fall into lap, they didn't have anything to do with it. So those kinds of things are not in our control. But Paschal are the things that you succeed, which are correspond to your efforts. We know that even when you succeed as a result of your efforts, it's not your efforts that does it. You do your hishtadlus, you make your efforts, HaKadosh Baruch Hu ultimately is the one that determines the success. But nevertheless, we could describe a correlation between your actions and your success, and that's the connection, he says, to the word seichel. You made the right choices. And he says that there are two ways that a person could succeed through his efforts. One is by making the right choices, and the other is by making midstream corrections. That if you made the wrong choice, you turn it around, and you figure out a way how to modify it and correct it to get back on track. So those are the two expressions in the pasuk. Leman taskil, that you should make successful choices, eis kol asher ta'aseh, everything you do, eis kol asher tifneh shem, in every way that you turn. And even if you start off in one direction, and you find it necessary to turn in another direction, that should be successful as well. So the implication here is that if a person keeps Torah and mitzvot, it's not simply siyata d'shmaya alone that he will have hatzlacha, the kind of just good luck that falls your way, but he will have the siyata d'shmaya in his actions and making the right choices and the right decisions. And if he should make the wrong choice, he'll be able to correct it and be able to modify it. The Mitzudas and others do interpret it in the more literal way. Taska means wisdom, seichel. It means everything you do should be with seichel. Every place that you turn should be with seichel. And they explain it to mean as follows. When it comes to serving Hashem, there are certain things which are spelt out in halacha, things which are usur, things which are mutter. But there is an enormous number of potential decisions that we make each and every day, and actions that we take each and every day, that are not specifically commanded, and they're not specifically asserted, they're not specifically prohibited. The area which we might naively refer to as rishus, optional. Halachos Avos points out, in the end, there's really no such thing as optional. Optional really means things that vary according to the circumstances. So the Torah didn't say it's absolutely usur because it isn't necessarily usur, and the Torah didn't say it's absolutely commanded because it isn't necessarily commanded. But if this action contributes in a positive way to your service of Hashem, then you're obligated to do it. And if it detracts from your service of Hashem, then you're obligated not to do it. But to figure that out is very difficult. And that's what the pasuk is saying, that if you keep everything that it says in the Torah, you will be able to figure out all those things that are not explicitly said in the Torah. And this is really quite spelled out in the Maseiros Yesharim when he discusses the Midah of Chassidus, and more specifically when he discusses Mishkal HaChassidus. Through the learning of Torah, through seeing what Hashem asks you to do, we could kind of figure out those things that perhaps Hashem didn't ask us to do. But you could be Madame and Milsel and Mils and compare one thing to the other. It's also quite apparent from this pasuk, and this is also spelled out in the Maseiros Yesharim, that this process only really works effectively when you do the mitzvahs. It's not enough to study the Torah. But he says, you have to study the Torah, but you have to keep the mitzvahs too, because the process of keeping Torah and mitzvahs cleanses the person of his negiyas, of his biases, of his physical drives. He becomes in control of himself, and once you're in control of yourself, in control of your yetzer, then you have a clear vision, and you're able to analyze these murky areas, these areas that are not clear-cut, and cannot necessarily be easily defined as asur mutter. And to give a rather simplistic example, but you know there are many, many, many more, and more complex and more difficult, take a simple act such as sleeping. Right, a person, there's a famous story of the Vilna Gaon only slept, I think, 2 hours every 24 hours. And the story is told that Rav Chaim Volozhin attempted to do the same thing as Talmud, and the Vilna Gaon noticed he was a little bit sleepy, you know, he'd come in and learn, he wasn't too sharp. So he asked him, what's going on? And he said, well, you know, he's trying to limit his sleep to 2 hours, you know, a day. So he says, you know, you think that when you're sleeping 2 hours a day, therefore you're Mekayim 22 hours of Talmud Torah. But the reality is you are being over on 22 hours of Bittul Torah. Because during those other hours that you're awake, your mind is not sharp, you're tired, you can't think straight, and you're not learning full capacity. So the Rambam says a person should get 8 hours of sleep. I don't know anybody who gets 8 hours of sleep, but 6 hours maybe. So he said that so you have to be able to judge. So of course, Reb Chaim asked the obvious question, but Rebbe doesn't. So the Vilna Gaon said, I have a unique metabolism. I don't need that much sleep. If I wouldn't be learning, I'd be doing something else, but I wouldn't be sleeping. So if I'm up anyway, what should I do? Waste my time? So you have to know whether you can handle it. So sleeping could be a mitzvah, and sleeping could be an avera. If you sleep, you know, pass and sleep in, miss, you know, Zman Kriya Shema, Minyan, everything else. Of course, I know nowadays, even if you miss Zman Kriya Shema, you don't necessarily miss Minyan. There's Minyanim all hours of the day. But whatever it is, so then the sleeping, but even without that, if a person isn't missing Minyan, but he's just sleeping too much, so he's wasting his time. He could have gotten by without being tired, without affecting his health, with less sleep. So then he shouldn't be sleeping that much. So the same action. Now, there's no iser in the Torah to sleep. There's no mitzvah in the Torah to sleep per se. It has to be judged and measured. Now, this message to Shlomo is particularly important because a leader, a king, a melech, a leader, has to do this even more than the average person. Because leadership decisions, you've got to try to figure out what impact it has, what effect it has. You have to be Ro'as HaNolad. Just like you have to figure out staying up those extra hours, what impact is it going to have? A king or a leader has impact on the entire country and on future generations. And it's an extremely difficult thing. And there's a story told in the city of Radin. Radin is mostly famous for the Chavetz Chaim. There was a yeshiva in Radin that the Chavetz Chaim founded. And there was a minhag. Radin was a small town. And there really were not a whole lot of people there, but there was a minhag in the town that if there was a funeral, there was a levaya in town, the yeshiva boys used to go to the levaya. If we tried that in New York, nobody would ever be in yeshiva. It's a big city. But in Radin, how often do they have a levaya? Maybe a few times a year. So that was a minhag. The yeshiva hired a mashkiach. The story is told without the name of the sheikh. I happen to know who it was because I heard it once with the name, but who later became a very famous person. So that's why the name isn't mentioned. If you know your history of Radin, you might be able to figure it out. But the mashkiach, they had a new mashkiach, and one day he sees the whole base manager is getting up, getting ready to leave. So he asks, what's going on? So they told him, when there's a funeral in town, you know, we go to the funerals. He says, that doesn't make any sense. Bittul Torah, you don't know the person, right? Stay in the Beis Medrash, you should learn. So they did. So Chavetz Chaim called in the Mashkiach and said, what did you do? He said, well, you know, I didn't see any reason why all the Bachrim in the Yeshiva, they don't even know the family, they don't know the people. Why should they all be Mevatel to go to the funeral? Said, that's very nice. But for the last whatever number of years, 20 years, they have been going to the funeral. So all of a sudden, this fellow passes away, and nobody's going to the funeral. What are people supposed to think? What's the widow supposed to think? Imagine what terrible complaints the yeshiva must have against this guy that nobody's going to the funeral. She has daughters to marry off. How is she going to make a shidduch? What are people going to think? This is the guy that they boycotted his funeral. So the Mashiach said, I didn't think of that. He says, if you didn't think of that, you can't be a manhig. You can't be a leader if you don't think of that. You need to be able to anticipate the effects of what you do as a leader. That's a very difficult task. And to get there, you need the seichel that comes from learning Torah and keeping Torah and mitzvahs and having that clear vision. Even simple things aren't so simple. Another story of the Chavetz Chaim. there was a at some point after World War One, there was a government in Poland issued a decree, a law, that basically required government workers, civil servants, to work on Shabbos or else lose their job. Until that point in time, you know, it was up to the individual supervisors. And sometimes you had a sympathetic supervisor, if you paid him off or whatever it was, they let you take off Shabbos. And now they made this rule basically geared against the Jews. If you don't work Shabbos, you're out. So there was a fear that people were going to cave in. You know, there's a big Nisayon. We know in America there was a big Nisayon as well, you know, for Shmir Shabbos. So they wanted to issue a proclamation, you know, urging everybody to be Moser Nefesh, that even if you're going to lose your job, then you shouldn't work on Shabbos. So they came to the Chafetz Chaim to sign the letter. Chafetz Chaim reads the letter, and he's sitting there, he's thinking, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. The person who brought the letter was a younger Rav, you know, who was being involved in this Indian, but it seemed like a no-brainer, right? It's a Pashta Halacha, that you're not allowed to be Mechal Shabbos for money, you're only allowed to be Mechal Shabbos for Pikuach Nefesh. So what's taking so long? So finally he couldn't restrain himself, and he said to the Chafetz Chaim, what's taking so long? Isn't it Pashut? So the Chafetz Chaim says, if you think it's Pashut, you sign the letter. So I'm trying to think, I'm trying to consider, I'm trying to imagine. Is it possible that there could be a circumstance where it's really Pikuach Nefesh? Perhaps there's an elderly person who's barely putting food on the table, cannot beg for money, has no relatives, and if he quits his job, he may die. Maybe he shouldn't quit his job, but he's going to see this proclamation signed by the Chafetz Chaim, and he's going to quit. So I'm trying to think, I'm trying to anticipate whether or not there's an unintended negative consequence. And therefore, I don't know whether he signed the letter in the end. Maybe he did. If you really want to do the research, they have collected Kol Kisvei Chafetz Chaim, and they included all the proclamations that he signed. So you could search through there, see if he signed one about the Shmir Shabbos in that time. But even if he did, he didn't do it just quickly. He thought it through. Be careful, because the mantaska is called shatase. It requires a great deal of seichel, a great deal of wisdom, to be able to figure out what the impact is of what you do. It's an interesting thing. There's a halachic ramification to that as well. We have many takanas derabana, but as time went on, we began to stop making takanas. Now here and there, you still have various local takanas, or you know they made haramim. But even in the Amoraim made very few takanas. Most of the takanas came from the Tanaim, and most of those takanas came from the earlier generations of the Tanaim. Because to make a takana, you have to be Roas HaNolad. You have to know what impact this is going to have for hundreds of years. And at a certain point, people began to feel that we don't really have that vision and insight to be able to determine that. So it's extremely difficult to make these kinds of decisions as a leader. So certainly, Shlomo HaMelech, who's going to be a king, needed that special boost, Laman Taskil, Eitz Kol Asher Tatz, Eitz Kol Asher Tifnesham. The next pasuk continues, Laman Yokim Hashem Es Devaro, in order that Hashem should fulfill His words, Asher Dibar Alai Lemer, they spoke to me, about me, saying, Im Yishmu Vanecha es darkam, if your children will follow their ways, the lechas lefanai them is to follow before me in truth, b'chol levavam v'chol nafshem, with all their hearts and all their souls, lemar, saying, this is obviously repetitive, he said lemar before, lo yikaris lechol ish v'al kisei Yisrael, there shall not be cut off from you a descendant from the throne of Israel. So in other words, if you do this, you keep the Torah, the mitzvahs, the edus, chukim, mishpatim, etc., lechas v'drachav, then Hashem will be able to fulfill His promise to me that your descendants will always remain on the throne of Israel. So is this Shalom Lishma? We always say that the best level of serving Hashem is to serve Hashem for the sake of keeping His mitzvot, not because He promised you you're going to be on the throne. So some people interpret it that it's not really shelo l'shma. It could be, of course, but that's not what David had in mind. It's that Hashem should have been able to fulfill his promise, because clearly that's what Hashem wants. If Hashem made that promise, this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. Just enable HaKadosh Baruch Hu to do what he wants. Rav Chaim Volozhin says a phenomenal thing. Rav Chaim Volozhin says that is really the yesod of all tefillah. You know, there's the famous question on tefillah that, listen, we believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows everything. He knows what's best for us even more than we do. HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves us, so he will do whatever he can to help us. So why are we davening? What difference does it make? And there are various different explanations. Maybe now is not really the time to go through all of them. Briefly, one of the fundamental answers is that one of the main functions of davening is for us, not for Hashem, that we should realize where it comes from. And if you don't ask, you just take it for granted. If you don't have that relationship that you come before HaKadosh Baruch Hu and make these requests, then you don't realize what that's coming from it. But the Rav Chaim Volozhin says the ikar yesod of tefillah is you're not davening for yourself, you're davening for Hashem. That you have the, you can't to ask for yourself, that's superfluous. But to worry about HaKadosh Baruch Hu's kavod, if you love HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then you worry about his kavod. So you're asking Hashem should do good for us because we represent Hashem in this world, and it'll be a bigger Kiddush Shem Shemayim. So obviously a very lofty level to be able to do that. But that's really what David had in mind. In fact, the Sfarim bring that when a person does averus, and therefore Hashem punishes him, it really is a double. It causes a double reaction. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is upset that you did the Avera, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is also upset that you made me punish you. The Lashon used in Chazal is Matriach. It was a Tircha. You nudged me, you bothered me. Now I have to go out of my way to punish you. Hashem doesn't want to have to do that. And I heard an explanation from Rabbi Victor Miller on what was always, for many years, puzzled me. A mashal that Rabbeinu Yonder brings in the beginning of the Shari Tshuva, and he's talking about the idea of doing tshuva, and he says that if a person realizes that he sinned and has an opportunity to do tshuva and doesn't do tshuva, it magnifies the transgression. And he gives a mashal. His mashal is as follows: there was a jail, a king's jail, and there was a jailer. And there's a number of prisoners in the jail. And they dug a tunnel to escape. And all the prisoners escaped except one. The tunnel was there and he didn't leave. So the jailer comes back, sees everyone's gone, sees the hole in the ground, sees this guy is here. And he gets all upset. He says, "Kishay Yom, you stubborn fool, you idiot." I don't know exactly what he said. How could you, the tunnel is open before you, how could you not escape? And what always disturbed me about this is, you know, in our laws, escaping from jail is a crime in and of itself. You know, I'm supposed to be in jail, why should I escape? Like, what are you getting mad for? And Rabbi Victor Miller explained that it wasn't the king who came and said this, it was the jailkeeper. The jailkeeper would prefer that nobody's in jail because he's collecting his paycheck. He doesn't have to do any work. So here, everybody escaped and you stayed behind and make me come to work for this one guy who, fool that you are, could have easily escaped as well. So he says, that's the nimshal. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I want you to escape. I'm the one who dug the tunnel. I gave you tshuva. Because I want you to escape. I don't want to have to come to, quote unquote, come to work and punish you. So I dug the hole for you. I want you to escape. And the fool that you are, you didn't take advantage. What am I supposed to do with you? Kishay Yom. That's the explanation. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want to have to punish us. He wants to fulfill his promises to us. He wants to do all the good things that he said he was going to do. And we're not letting him. So therefore, David says to Shlomo, let HaKadosh Baruch Hu do what he wants to do. We mentioned before just a moment ago that there's really a repetition in this pasuk. We say Hashem should fulfill His words, Lamar, meaning this is a quote of what Hashem said, and then in the middle of that quote we say Lamar again. The Malbim gives what I would call a somewhat technical explanation. In general, we have a rule that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes a promise, if you call it that, I don't know what the proper term is, but tells you something He's going to do, which is negative, which is bad, He isn't necessarily going to do it. There's always the possibility of tshuva, and it can be reversed. So anything that HaKadosh Baruch Hu predicts that is lira does not necessarily have to happen. There are ways to get out. But anything that HaKadosh Baruch Hu predicts l'tov, Hashem does no matter what. And in fact, the entire institution of Nevuah is predicated on that. Because if there was no such commitment from Hashem, you'd never be able to tell who was a false Navi, who was a truthful Navi. Because the person can come with the Nevuah, if it's bad, he says, well, Hashem had Rachmanis, He didn't do it. If it's good, Hashem changed His mind, you sinned. So then you're not held to your predictions, you're not accountable. This way, at least when you say something l'tov, you're accountable. But that's only true when a Kadosh Baruch Hu says something l'tov, but where it is specifically stipulated that it is conditional, so then that's not necessarily the case. And this promise to David that his descendants would remain on the throne and not be interrupted was specifically conditional. And that's the reason he says why Lamor is repeated, that to indicate that the second Lamor is dependent on the first Lamor. Hashem said, Lamor, im yishmeru, if you keep all the mitzvahs and do everything that's right, b'chol levavcha u'nafshecha, Hashem, then Lamor, I make the second statement that not lo yikaris necham al kisei Yisrael. But if you don't keep the first Lamor, you don't get the second Lamor. And this gift was specifically conditional, and of course, we know that Taka did not last forever because we did sin and the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. The Kli Yakar has a different interpretation. The Kli Yakar says that this Lamor, according to the Malbim, the Lamor, you might say, is a restriction of the promise of Hashem. According to the Kli Yakar, it's an expansion, because the first part of the pasuk sets a very high standard. In Yeshua Nechaz Darkam, they follow their way to Lechaz Afanei Be'emes, to be sincere in going before me, B'chol Levavam, with all their heart, B'chol Nafsha. That implies, what if they do keep the mitzvahs, and they do keep the Torah, but it's not mamish, 100% sincere, it's not B'chol Levavam, B'chol Levavcham, that all bets are off. Not necessarily, it's not good enough. So the pasuk repeats Lamer, is a second statement. Lo yikaris l'chei Yisrael kisei Yisrael, even if you don't meet the standards. Ideally, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants is v'chol levavcha v'chol nafshecha. But if you don't manage to pull it off on that level, but at least you do what David said, lishmar chukosu mitzvosu mishpatu ve'edvosu v'chatsu v'toris Moshe, maybe not v'chol levavcha v'chol nafshecha, that would be enough to retain the throne and to retain the melucha. The Abarbanel points out something else from this pasuk. Apparently, I don't know who he's referring to, but there was some school of thought, I don't know if it was Jewish or not Jewish, or, you know, what it was, but he makes reference to a school of thought that basically said that all the promises that you find in the Torah, if you keep mitzvahs, things will be good, they're not really rewards, they're cause and effect. As if you behave, if everyone lives a good life and does proper things, society will flourish. So there will be all kinds of positive positive consequences. But it's really, you know, I suppose this type of philosophy might go along with certain other philosophies that were certainly common in the period of Rishonim, to feel that God doesn't involve Himself in the world. He created the world and somehow withdraws and lets the world run by itself. So some mitzvahs create good events. Yeah, all right, because Hashem gave you a nice battle plan. If you keep to that battle plan, things will work out. There was even more recent years, a more modern school of thought called utilitarianism, you know, where people said the basics of ethics is to keep society running smoothly. Right? If everyone were to steal, society would break down. So it's a good idea not to steal. It always struck me that those type of arguments tend to be a little bit unpersuasive to the individual. It's great for the klal. But if one guy steals, society will not break down. So I might as well be that one guy. I'll make more money. You know the story they tell about where the community was supposed to chip in to make for some community celebration. So there was a barrel. They were even supposed to pour in a little cup of schnapps. So they have a barrel of schnapps for the celebration. So the guy figures, listen, if I pour in water, one cup of water, who's going to know the difference? And then they opened up the barrel and it was all water. So, you know, whatever it may be, that behaving in a proper manner brings upon proper results. Says the Abarbanel, it's much more than that. There is a specific hashgacha pratis. And behaving in a proper manner, maybe it doesn't address the issue whether it does, in a cause and effect way, bring good results, but it's much more than that. It says, L'man yokim Hashem es devaro. Hashem fulfills His word. It's not simply that it brings cause and effect. The Kli Yoker points out further, based on this interpretation of the Abarbanel, he says that the pasuk emphasizes b'chol levavam v'chol nafshecha. If it was cause and effect, it really wouldn't matter how much your heart is in it. Whether you do it because you really, really want to do it to serve Hashem, you just do it. Listen, all right, it's a good idea, I'll do it. You're doing the same things. And if it brought some cause and effect benefits, but it wouldn't be a greater benefit if you did it b'chol levavam v'chol nafshecha, less of a benefit if you didn't. So clearly, there's direct intervention from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It could be that there is a cause and effect benefit. It is true that people don't steal, society runs better. It is true that people do chesed to one another, it's a better life. It is true that people will find fulfillment and be happier. So there is a certain cause and effect relationship between mitzvahs and good things. But beyond the cause and effect, it's much, much more. And that additional divine intervention aspect, the reward aspect, is very much based on Taharas Halev, how much of your heart and how much of your soul you put into it. And Rabbi Saul Salanter says that it could very well be the difference between doing a mitzvah in a half-baked, reluctant way and doing a mitzvah b'Taharas Halev with a pure heart, with dedication, is greater than the difference between doing the mitzvah and not doing the mitzvah. And as if you didn't do the mitzvah, zero to a half-hearted mitzvah is a certain distance, 100 miles. A half-hearted mitzvah to a mitzvah b'shleimus, lishma, might be 1,000 miles. So there might be more involved in the differential in the taras alev, the chol levavam chol nafshecha, than the action itself. Obviously, without the action, you're getting no place. But once you've done the action, there still be much more territory to transverse. There's much more to accomplish than simply doing the action. Okay, we're getting up to one of the I found more difficult segments in Navi. It's we've been skirting around the issue until now, but now we're going to have to confront it, and that is the issue of Yoav. Who was Yoav? I mean, we know he was the general in David Melech's regime, right-hand man. And, of course, David is about to give instructions that Yoav should be punished for the various offenses that he committed over the years. Question is, if he deserved to die, why didn't David kill him beforehand? Why is David allowing Yoav to go on? The crimes that David mentions, some of them happened 40 years prior, some were more recent. But if David was so upset, and if David felt that Yoav deserved to die, then why didn't he do it himself? And if he didn't do it himself, why is he telling Shlomo to do it? And if in truth, if Yoav did deserve to die, so wasn't there a Sanhedrin, wasn't there a court, why didn't they convict him? How did Yoav do all these things? Was he a tzaddik or was he a rasha? So it's a very difficult parsha. And by way of introduction, I don't think we're going to get through it all today. Gives me more time to figure this out. By way of introduction, there is a Sefer Parshas Drachim that discusses the issue of Mored v'Malchus, and it would seem that the ultimate downfall of Yoav was Mored v'Malchus, and we'll discuss that in more detail when we meet Hashem next week. And his position is that, and he really asks this as a kasha on the whole story of Yoav, is that Melech Shemachal al Kavodo ain't Kavodo Machal. So a king does not have the right to forgive his honor. And if you will say that David decided to spare Yoav, on what right or on what basis did he do that? Others answer this question, and they support the answer from a Rambam. And what they say is, kavod is one thing and onesh is something else. Melech shemachal al kavodo ein kavodo machal. But it doesn't necessarily mean that he has to punish everybody for violating it. Punishment comes after the fact. So the punishment has a certain amount of discretion. The king, the reason why a king has the authority to punish a rebel is in order to solidify the kingdom, in order to make sure that the country runs properly. A king has the discretion to make a decision that it may be better to forego the punishment. Not to be mochel, but not to punish. And that's really what David did. David didn't punish Yoav, but he wasn't mochel Yoav either. The relevant Lashonos in the Rambam, I wrote down here, this is the Rambam Hilchos Melachim Perek Gimel Halacha Ches, Yesh Lemelech Rishus Lahargal. Says if a person rebels against the king or insults him or defies his authority, Yesh Lemelech Rishus, the key word, the king has permission to kill him. That implies that he has permission, but he's not obligated. The Rambam in the Sefer Mitzvot has a similar lashon. He says, Hine ra'uy umutar lemelech lahargo kemo sheyirta. It is appropriate and permissible for the king to kill him as he desires. Kemosha Yirta implies, but if he decides not to, he has the right not to as well. Now here the Rambam says Lashon Ra'uy, it's appropriate. What that implies is that it shouldn't be capricious. The king shouldn't just say, well, you know, I feel sorry for him, he's not such a bad guy, I'll let him go. There has to be a legitimate reason. Where the king makes a decision that it's better off for Klal Yisrael and for the Melucha not to kill him rather than to kill him. So that would be the first element. If we're dealing in the realm of Mored v'Malchus, then there's room for the king's discretion. That still needs to resolve the question, why, what is the discretion? Why did David decide not to kill him? And why does that change when it comes to Shlomo? So Mir Tzeshem will get to that.